This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I have a warning for you that may very well affect you and your loved ones. We'll talk about that in a moment. Is James Comey actually going to prison? Color me skeptical on that. Selena Zito joins us to talk about the Trump assassination attempt, all that and more coming up on I'm Right. Okay, before we get into my warning to you and how we need to possibly make some adjustments going forward, you and I'm talking about us personally. I want to discuss something we've talked about at length before, but you kind of have to understand this concept to understand what we're facing right now. Communism in general, it is a revolutionary religion. Remember, it is very much a religion. It's not an ideology. It's not a political party. It's a religion, and it's revolutionary. It is revolting against everything that exists, all the standing institutions, standing governments, standing countries. The communists believe it all must be burnt down. So they are fighting a revolution. You may be voting or caring about this tax issue or border issue. They're fighting a revolution. That's the difference in the mentality. And now and always, this exists today in America. It existed in Cambodia, in China, in East Germany, in the Soviet Union. Now and always, there are two different kinds of communists, two different divisions, if you will. They work together, but there are two different divisions. There are elite communists and there are street communists. The elite communists generally aren't true believers. They care about power. They're politicians and judges and police chiefs and generals. They're the elite of society, wealthy people, billionaires. And they want to burn things down because it helps them make money and gain power. That's one division. Then there's the street division. Elites, streets. The streets are the rabid animals you see gluing themselves to highways, Black Lives Matter protests, LGBTQ demon stuff where they're waving their penis in your daughter's face. The street animals, they're the ones on the streets, usually mentally ill, usually paid, organized, always violent. They are the ones who vandalize, who murder, who assault, and they are primed to do this. They are a standing army, and they are the true believers. So how do they work together? Well, the elites find things they want destroyed because it benefits them. And so they signal. Sometimes they say it outright. Sometimes it's vague. They signal to the streets, hey, here's a guy. Be sure nice if somebody hurt him. And the street animals hear those marching orders and they march forward and they hurt him. The arrangement is, how do they stay out of jail? The elites provide legal protection for the streets to do the evil. Communism has always worked that way, will always work that way, and works that way right now in the United States of America. And that brings me to what we have going on here. I'm not going to insult your intelligence and act like you haven't seen endless amounts of street communism in this country. No matter how old you are, 8 or 88, you've seen these animals in the streets doing what they do for a long time. They'll burn down a city block and, yeah, they'll kill somebody and vandalize and do those things. Yeah, I got that. You got that. Right now, there is an escalation that I have not seen in my lifetime. I understand this kind of escalation has existed before. I don't want to say it hasn't. There used to be a big organized group, the Weather Underground. We're talking nail bombs, killing cops, that kind of a thing. So it has existed before in this country, but not in my lifetime. They're getting more organized. They're getting more violent. You may have laughed off. I kind of laughed off. Some dirtball showed up at an ICE facility in Texas and got capped. He showed up, decided to get in a shootout with some studs and Bortak. those are the SWAT team for Border Patrol, got killed, and we were all like, ah, ha, ha, guy got crazy, lost, ah, ha, ha, what an idiot. But that was how it ended. What was attempted was very serious.
At the Prairie Land ICE Detention Center in Alvarado, Texas, 10 to 12 individuals dressed in black military-style clothing began shooting fireworks and engaging in acts of vandalism at the facility. And this was part of an organized attack. Today, my office has charged 10 individuals with three counts of attempted murder of a federal officer. Each of the 10 are also charged with three counts of discharging a firearm in relation to a crime of violence. Each of these defendants faces a mandatory prison term of 10 years and up to life in prison. It was a planned ambush with the intent to kill ICE corrections officers. Make no mistake, this was not a so-called peaceful protest. It was indeed an ambush.
It was an ambush, poorly planned, poorly executed by the grace of God. But this was not a few freaks on the streets of Portland throwing bricks through a window or even shooting someone in the head with all the things they've done. This was a terrorist cell that made preparations and plans to kill federal law enforcement officers. Why would they do such a thing? Tom Holman explained exactly why.
Who were these suspects who were fired, who actually fired the shots and were later arrested? Who were they, Tom?
Look, they're your typical protesters that go from protesters to criminals. The attack on ICE officers, you've covered it many times, is up nearly 700%. Now, we were talking 500% a couple weeks ago, so it continues. The rhetoric against the men and women of ICE is skyrocketing, especially by members of Congress. We have senators, we have Congress people that compare ICE to the Nazis, compare ICE to racists, and it just continues. So the public thinks, well, if a member of Congress can attack ICE, why can't we? So the rhetoric has to stop.
The rhetoric. What is rhetoric from Democrat elites, the elite communists? It's orders. It's marching orders. Remember, famously, Chuck Schumer got up and said Justice Kavanaugh would reap the whirlwind. About 5 minutes afterwards, some psychopathic street communist flew from California with a gun ready to execute Brett Kavanaugh outside of his house. Democrat rhetoric isn't rhetoric. It's interpreted by the street animals in this country as orders, marching orders. There's the bad guy. There's your target. Go, kill, destroy. And as they get more and more desperate, which they are right now, the rhetoric will and is increasing, and therefore the violence will and is increasing. Rhetoric like this.
According to Axios, some are even being told they need to be more willing to go out there and get shot when fighting. That was a direct quote, get shot when fighting back against some of Trump's policies. One House Democrat saying, quote, and I'll read it to you, our own base is telling us that what we're doing is not good enough. There needs to be blood to grab the attention of the press and the public. How do you respond to that, Leader Jeffries? Are Democrats not meeting the moment, not doing enough to fight these developments?
Well, we are in a more is more environment in terms of the unprecedented assault on the American way of life and our country that has been launched by Donald Trump and compliant House Republicans.
This president has unleashed a war on our own people and our communities. It is terrorizing our communities.
They are not going after criminals. They're going after anybody that is brown, that looks like me, that can't pass as what they say as a typical American.
They're going to arrest me for doing my job. I mean, as mayor, my number one responsibility is to keep Angelino safe. Now, it never dawned on me that I would have to worry about keeping Angelino safe from my own government.
You heard that. You heard a lot of different things in there. Lies, all kinds, distortions, things like that. Talking points. But the mentally ill street communist sitting at home with nothing to live for, a drug addiction, a bunch of violent turbo freak friends, probably came from a broken home. That freak sitting at home hears Democrats and media people speak like that, and the freak sitting at home interprets that as marching orders to kill. That is simply a fact. And the rhetoric is increasing. Now the violence is increasing. Now to my warning to you, before I let you go, and we'll move on. We're going to talk, is James Comey going to prison, things like that. They just organized and planned an ambush on an ICE facility to kill federal officers. It didn't work out well because getting in a gunfight with people who shoot guns more often than you do oftentimes doesn't work out that well. But they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop being mentally ill, violent. Democrats are not going to tone down their rhetoric. I don't care how many times you or I call for it. This is now going to increase from here. Organized, planned street violence. And the animals who commit this kind of violence are going to move on from hard targets like BORTAC, and they're going to come to your church. They're going to come to your child's school. That Little League game you're going to this Saturday, no big deal. Someone grab the beer. They're going to come there. They're going to find soft targets where they can hurt the people they want to hurt. They're not going to accept failure forever. This is not to get you to hide or even be afraid or stay in your home. This is to let you know to keep your eyes open, carry if you can, and be ready to protect yourself, because organized street communism in this country is going to increase from here. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. Get yourself some chop, too. Get your energy up, your focus up. I have been on a male vitality stack from Chalk for over 3 years now. I feel like a new human being. If you don't want to go that route, these are all natural herbal supplements. Maybe start your day with Chalk lit powder. Just do that for a week. Tell me how much better you feel, your body, your mind. When you start getting natural, wonderful things in your body, it changes your entire life. Go to chalk.com/JesseTV. That gets you a 17.76% discount. We'll be back. Talk to one of my favorites, Miranda Devine. Her Pod Force One podcast is going gangbusters, maybe because she keeps getting people like Donald Trump and J.D. Vance. And now the chief of staff, Susie Wiles, on there. Joining me now is the great Miranda Devine. Okay, Miranda, Susie Wiles. Now, inside people, look, you're going to know who Susie Wiles is, obviously. People watch this show are, but a lot of people don't really understand who she is, where she came from, what's her role. Tell me about her.
Susie Wiles is the most powerful woman in the world. That's what Donald Trump calls her, and it's actually true. She's his chief of staff. She's a very sort of private and retiring person. Donald Trump also calls her the Ice Maiden, but I found her to be incredibly warm. I've met her a few times now. She doesn't like to do interviews, and she thinks that that's not her role. And so it was a great honor that she agreed to do Podforce One with us. And she's just a fascinating study because she's worked in Republican politics, most of her career. She took 10 years off. She's a mum to bring up her two kids. She's also the daughter of Pat Summerall, who, of course, is the legendary sportscaster who really kind of, as she said, pioneered the sort of network sports romances that he had with a couple of, including Madden, and just the most superb professional in that ilk. And she's a little like him, I think. He was very instrumental in her life, and she talks about that. She talks about the fact that he was an alcoholic at the end of his career, and that it was a letter that she wrote to her father when her mother organized an intervention. That letter that Susie Wiles wrote, which was pretty sharp, pretty truthful, and pretty hurtful to him, that was what made him turn the corner, and that's what he had said, and achieve sobriety for the next 30 years. So she's used in that family to her mother bringing order to chaos, which you get from addiction in the family, and she herself has brought order to the chaos that is the White House, that always is, but particularly when you have a disruptor like Donald Trump. So she really makes the trains run on time, is what she says. But she also makes sure that she takes care of all the problems that come up and manages all the staff and all the cabinet so that Donald Trump, in her words, has thinking time and the ability to do his job without worrying about all the penny ante stuff that he did in his first term.
Miranda, it sounds to me like she's the one who gets the credit for the difference in White Houses, because the first time, it's just not deniable, it was such a disaster. Every day it's a new leak, they're hiring a new moron. It was just awful, day after day after day of that. And this time there's none of it. It's day and night. It's a black and white difference. Is that Susie Wiles?
I think so, although I did put that to her. She is also someone who has one of the great virtues of humility. So she does not accept that. What she says is that Donald Trump is a very different person from what he was in his first term. And she attributes that to the fact that, I mean, when he first came to Washington, he had only been there a few times. He was a businessman. He didn't have the right group of people around him. And he was sabotaged from the get-go with the Russia hoax, Barack Obama's henchmen, James Comey and John Brennan and James Clapper. So that was a difficult situation for him. Then she said he had the 4 years in between of being in exile where he could look back on the mistakes he made in the first term and also see how badly, the country would go downhill with a bad president like Joe Biden. And then he came in with a much better team. And yes, Susie Wiles, she wouldn't really attribute it to herself, but she is just such an organized person, such a calm person. She doesn't speak much, but when she speaks, her words really carry import. People listen to her. Donald Trump listens to her. He asks for her advice. She's very sage. And she comes across as a very, to me, warm and motherly and grandmotherly person. That is the way she acts to her staff, the people, lots of younger staff is around her. But when she needs to be, she is mean. And Donald Trump calls her rough and tough because she doesn't like to be like that. But she is very capable of going toe-to-toe with adversaries. You talked a bit about Ron DeSantis, who tried to destroy her career and make sure she never got a job again. He was her nemesis, and she became his. And so you wouldn't want to be on the wrong side of Susie Wiles, but I think it takes a lot to get on her wrong side. She's a pretty pleasant, normal, balanced human being.
Let me shift gears here and let's talk about John Brennan and James Comey. Don't get me wrong. I was thrilled to hear there is a criminal investigation, but the old mean cynic in me, Miranda, kind of scoffed and has blown the whole thing off. And honestly, I'm still blowing the whole thing off. I don't think we ever see these kinds of people behind bars, but I'm thrilled if I turn out to be wrong. Tell me how legit all this is.
Yeah, look, I share your cynicism. I think we've all been up and down with a lot of hope for a lot of investigations, a lot of accountability that's never come over the last 4 years plus. So, of course, we have to be cynical. But in this particular case, I hold out some hope. John Ratcliffe, the CIA director, ordered this review, which was declassified last week, into that bogus intelligence community assessment that John Brennan drove on the orders of Barack Obama with Jim Comey and Jim Clapper. That basically was the beginning of the Russiagate hoax, and it was about Trump-Russia collusion. After the two-year Mueller investigation, it was found that there was no Trump-Russia collusion. But this intelligence community assessment was built around the Steele dossier, which was totally made up fiction by a British spy Christopher Steele's former British spy, just made up garbage about ridiculous, salacious tales about Donald Trump that weren't true. And John Brennan forced that Steele dossier into this intelligence community assessment, which, as his own analyst said, would discredit the entire thing. And that's what it did. And so John Brennan's always said, lied, and said, oh no, he didn't push the Steele dossier into the intelligence community. He didn't know anything about the Steele dossier. Oh, I don't know how it got there. And it wasn't used anyway, is what he said. Well, we now know from his own words, from an email that John Brennan wrote himself to his own analysts who were pushing back on using the Steele dossier, that he forced them. He said, you have to use this. That was part of the declassified report, the review that John Ratcliffe released last week. And that forms the basis, I believe, of a perjury charge against him, or perjury referral. It's not a charge yet, but certainly the FBI has had referred to it from the CIA, these allegations about both John Brennan and Jim Comey. Now, the statute of limitations will have run out. It's 5 years for perjury. It will have run out on the initial lies that he told in testimony to Congress. But he's also, John Brennan, testified behind closed doors to the Durham investigation, and also, I believe, to James Comer's investigations into Joe Biden. So, you know, you can just assume that he would have told the same lies that he was telling in public for many years and that he testified to in Congress before, that no, he didn't know about the, no, the Steele dossier was not used in that assessment, and no, he had nothing to do with any referral to it. The Steele dossier was not just used as an annex in that assessment. It was used in the main body. And so it did discredit the whole thing. It did damage not just to Donald Trump, but to America's national security. And so certainly John Brennan and Jim Comey should be prosecuted. Let's hope that that will happen. At the moment, it's in the hands of the FBI and Kash Patel. And I think the clock is ticking down on the statute of limitations.
It is Pod Force One. Go listen to Miranda interview all the most powerful people while I talk about pizza on my show. Miranda, thank you so much. I appreciate it. All right. What did the Supreme Court do? Did they say Donald Trump can fire all the federal employees? No. No, that's not what they said, but they did do something good. We'll talk to Bill about that in a moment. Before we talk to Bill, let me talk to you about something that's pure, pure talk. See what I did there? Anyway, don't you appreciate companies that hire American? I do. I'll be honest, I never used to. I'm not proud of that, but when I was younger, I just, whatever, don't care, who cares, just give me what I want, I'm made in China, doesn't matter to me. And I remember older guys would scold me about that. Oh, and I'd blow it off, you know, but it really does matter. And it's really cool when a company like Pure Talk, they hire Americans. All these cell phone companies, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, all of them, they'll go shopping around the planet, find that cheap labor. Then when you get a hold of somebody there, you can't understand them. They can't understand you. It's frustrating. You're screaming at the phone. Not Pure Talk. Led by a Vietnam veteran, America means enough to Pure Talk that they hire Americans. They'll also save you money on your cell service. They also make it easy to switch. PureTalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. You know, it's almost impossible to fire federal employees, or at least traditionally it has been. And it may sound like not a big deal, but it's a gigantic deal. The people you elect, they'll get into office, and the federal workforce can oftentimes completely defy them. And you can't fire these daggone people. They're like leeches. Is that about to change? I don't know. Supreme Court just decided something. We better ask Bill Jacobson about that. Joining me now, founder of Legal Insurrection, Cornell University law professor Bill Jacobson. Okay, Bill, what is this decision? What does it mean?
So the Supreme Court granted a stay, which means put a hold on an injunction from federal district court in California, which prevented the federal government from moving forward under a Trump executive order, which called on, I think it was 19 different departments to develop plans for large-scale layoffs. So the district court stopped them from even planning to do anything, which went up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which refused to grant a stay pending appeal. They then took it up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, 8-1, with Ketanji Brown Jackson dissenting, in a fairly fiery dissent, dissenting, and granted a stay. And there's many reasons why they granted the stay, but what we can discern from the short opinion, as well as the opinion of Justice Sotomayor, who agreed with them, is what is the court below doing? All the executive order says is start planning. The executive order didn't lay anybody off. So a federal district court judge stopped them from even planning and therefore enjoined plans which didn't even yet exist. And the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to allow that to happen. This lower court order is stayed. They can move forward with the planning.
Okay, so there aren't going to be mass layoffs as of right now. All this said is you can start planning for mass layoffs, just to make sure I have that correct.
That's right. And Ketanji Brown-Jackson dissented from that.
Go ahead.
She dissented from it.
You said it was a fiery dissent. Why?
Because she used a lot of the sort of language she's used before, very accusatory towards her colleagues, very accusatory towards the court, and ignoring what she called the reality on the ground. I mean, she literally used a term, if I didn't quote it precisely, it was very close to that. The district court judge knows better what's happening on the ground, which is, of course, just an absurd assertion. And she's done that before. And the court is once again ignoring, you know, the rights of different citizens, et cetera. And so it was just very accusatory towards the majority, towards the court. And one thing that's interesting is that it was also, in a sense, accusatory against the two other liberals, because both Kagan and Sotomayor voted with the majority. And Kagan wrote a separate decision, which clearly was directed towards Justice Jackson, and said, look, basically, you don't seem to understand. We don't even have a plan to rule on. All the executive order did is say they could create a plan. Once we have that plan, then we can rule on whether it's lawful or not. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So she felt the need. You know, a lot of people use the expression, explain this to me like I'm a fifth grader, okay? That's what Justice Sotomayor did for Justice Jackson. She explained it to her like she was a fifth grader in very simple terms that apparently Justice Jackson, to the end, was unable to grasp, because she continued with her 10-page dissent, which really was not grounded in anything. And this is what we're seeing a lot from her. She gets very accusatory towards people who disagree with her. She gets very nasty towards them in her dissents. And we saw a couple of weeks ago, I think I discussed it on your show, how Amy Coney Barrett lashed out at her, basically said all the thing. This was a different case. This was the so-called birthright citizenship case, that, you know, all the things Justice Jackson is saying in her dissent are contrary to 200 years of constitutional law. And now Sotomayor had to say something similar, a little kinder, but it basically was, okay, Justice Jackson, I'm going to explain this to you like you're a fifth grader. Here's why we need to grant the stay. And so that's what's really astounding, is that none of the other justices, 8, including 2 liberal justices, really don't seem to have a lot of respect for Justice Jackson.
Okay, Bill, obviously you are much more wired into the law school realm than I am. It's not that I think lawyers or judges are automatically brilliant, but my sister went through law school, had to pass the bar in several different states. The amount of research and writing and things, it was astounding, the amount of information she had to hoover up in order to move forward with that career. How does someone rise to a Supreme Court justice who apparently is so dumb, even fellow liberals are marveling at what she doesn't know?
Yeah, that is astounding. She is a social justice warrior. It's coming through in her writings very clearly. Whenever people say, well, is critical race theory ever going to infect the court system? I said, if you want to read how critical race theory is infecting the system now, read Justice Jackson's dissent in the affirmative action case. It was total political verbiage, total anything you might hear in a social justice course in college. And so I think it's a combination of her having the right politics for Democrats to get ahead. And President Biden at the time said why he was picking her. He picked her because he wanted a black woman on the court. He wanted that first. There is no question she would not have been selected but for that racial gerrymandering by President Biden. So that's how she got ahead. She got ahead through favoritism. She got ahead through being a social justice warrior. She's not a stupid person. I didn't mean to suggest that, but she obviously lets her politics influence her legal analysis. Remember in the birthright citizenship case, she criticized the court for getting hung up on all this, quote, legalese, close quote. Well, wait a second. That's your job as a judge. You're supposed to get hung up on legalese, okay? So I think the main problem with her is that she's not the brightest bulb in the theater, but she's not a stupid person, but she got ahead through being a social justice warrior.
Golly. All right, let's shift gears. I do want to ask this before I get to Thomas and Alito and retirement things. Why was there an injunction at all? I thought we got rid of that with the last Supreme Court decision.
Well, this was an injunction against a particular executive order. So I'm not sure it really would have fallen under the so-called universal injunction sort of problem that the Supreme Court dealt with. It really just enjoined the government from implementing a particular executive order. Whether it would have had a different outcome post, you know, Supreme Court decision, I don't know, but I don't think it would have made a difference here.
All right, shifting gears here. I love Alito. I love Thomas, as anybody with a brain does. But Father Time is undefeated. Are there whispers about potential retirements? I'm not even saying I'm trying to shove them out the door because I love those men, but we don't want a Democrat to replace them, and that's always a possibility. What's the rumor mill say?
Yeah, I think there were, I'm not sure if there were rumors or thoughts. People are expecting that one or both of them will retire on a timing that would allow Trump to name a replacement. That may not happen. And the most famous case of it not happening is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who hung on just a little bit too long, and Trump got to name her replacement. And so that's hanging over everybody. We don't want Alito or Thomas to go Ginsburg here. But they're both seemingly in good shape. They're certainly in good mental shape. As was Ginsburg, there would be a real loss to the court to lose either one of them, but they have to be conscious that, you know, they don't want some future Democrat president to name their replacement. They, you know, do not want the equivalent of a, you know, Justice Jackson to replace them, some social justice warrior. And those are the types of judges Biden has appointed to the lower courts. So it's the expectation that they will retire more so than the rumor that they're making plans to retire.
Bill, as always, I appreciate you, sir. Come back. All right. There's an anniversary we're forgetting about. We shouldn't be. Selena Zito, wonderful journalist, joins us next to discuss it. Hang on.
If you want to really see something that's sad, take a look at what happened.
Watch out.
Such an unbelievable moment, wasn't it? That was almost a year ago, July 13th, 2024. I feel like that moment should have lasted longer. Maybe we don't live in that society anymore. I'm not complaining. I'm not doing the back in my day thing, but maybe there's just too much information, too many new scandals. But I really feel like that one should have lasted a little longer in the memory bank. Joining me now, my friend, wonderful author, writer, Selena Zito, wrote the book on that day you really should be picking up called Butler. Selena, I don't want to be Grandpa Jesse, but I feel like we do forget about some huge stories really fast now. Is that a social media thing?
Well, I would push back on that with a nuanced reason. And it did last. It still lasted. It just didn't last in the legacy media in the way that it should have and handled properly that way. But that left a mark on all of us. It not only changed the course of that campaign, it not only changed that man and the conversations that I had with him that day and days after, but it also completely changed the America's trust in the media. What little was left was gone immediately. And so that lived on in a way that is very different than we traditionally think things will linger in the American, in our culture. But mark my words, I mean, that's part of why this entire book was written. That moment hasn't left us, and it still hasn't.
Selena, you said it changed the man in significant ways. You've spent tons of time with President Trump. Explain.
So the president called me the next morning. If people will find out when they read the book that he called me the next morning. I was only 4 feet away. And there was a bunch of reasons, comical and not comical, that I was standing there. But he called me the next morning, crack of dawn in the morning. And he's like, Selena, are you okay? My daughter, who took the photo for the book, cover of the book, is your daughter okay? And gee, I'm really sorry we didn't do that interview. Which I thought was a little bit funny considering he'd been shot and he was thinking about me and an interview. But we had some very profound conversations. He called me 7 times that day. We talked a lot and I gave him a lot of space to talk. I didn't push him. I didn't press him. Sometimes I didn't say anything at all. And if anybody knows me, that's not something I usually do. I'm always talking. And I just let him work through it. And he kept saying to me, why did I turn my head? I never turned my head. Why did I bring that chart down? And as he's having this conversation with me, he says, was that God? And he answers his own question. He said, yeah, that was God. And that was the hand of God, which is what he eventually says several times. And he says, I believe I have a different purpose now. If I am lucky enough to become president again, I have a different purpose because I was saved in that moment and I was saved for that purpose. And I think it's important for your listeners to know this, is that people have all these assumptions as to why he said fight, fight, fight. They think it has to do with vanity. Not at all. It has to do with the projection of the American presidency. He said, in that moment, I was not Donald Trump. I was the president. I had been the president of the United States. I might likely be the president again. It was incumbent on me. It was my obligation to show strength. I could not let the country falter in that moment because it could happen. People behind me could have panicked. People in front of me could have panicked. People in the country could have panicked. They needed to know that the country had grit, that it still retained its exceptionalism. And that we continue on. And I thought that was not only powerful in that moment, but it became sort of the resounding theme throughout that campaign, but also every day in this presidency. It is very different than 2017. Very, very different. This is a man who knows he was saved for a reason. And this is a man who believes there is a purpose for him being saved. And he needs to live up to that, no matter what the political consequences are.
Selena, you said that was the last of the American public's trust in the media. Can you explain that? Look, I don't need any help to hate the media any more than I already do, but they didn't take the shots. What do you mean?
So if you remember, and again, we are loaded on with tons of information, the first couple stories that came out said that there was a disruption and there was an incident. And then they said, and then for a couple of days, it was there, he was hit by glass. He wasn't hit by a bullet. Right. And people could see with their own eyes that none of that was true. And so that right there, it was sort of like, you know, the Wizard of Oz, and the curtain was peeled back. They've already been leading up to distrusting the media because the media kept saying that Joe Biden was fine. It was great. And then they're saying, and Donald Trump really wasn't hurt that bad. He's fine. And it was a clash of moments, a clash of significance, that no matter what the media said after that moment, it was ultimately dismissed by the American public because it was what happened was right in front of them, and they stubbornly dug in their heels to say it didn't happen.
Selena, why don't we know more about this shooter? That's the part that bothers me the most. The man carried out a successful assassination attempt of the almost Republican nominee for president. If Donald Trump doesn't turn his head, Donald Trump is dead. That assassination attempt was planned and executed really well.
Yeah,
he did.
It really was. You know, the problem with Thomas Matthew Crooks is multi-layered. First of all, this young man was a loner. Now, there are a lot of loners out there that leave a ton of breadcrumbs to find, right? They leave evidence everywhere because they take that energy of loneliness and pour it into writing or things they put on social media. He did not do that. And that was the challenge in trying to understand what happened. It doesn't help that his parents lawyered up. So there's no ability to question, and there's no ability to press. And I think you had an administration in the Biden administration that wasn't willing to push on this incident. They just went through the motions. Now, I suspect that's probably very different now. As I understand it, there has been vigorous looking into it. But, you know, it could also be as simple as this was a kid who got mocked and made fun of in high school for being terrible for trying out for the rifle team. And he was going to go show everyone that he wasn't terrible. It could be that simple. I'm not saying it is, but we can't discount that that might exactly be what it is.
Selena, thank you so much. Come back soon. All right. We'll be back. All right, it is time to lighten the mood. And I still have Independence Day hanging on me. Now, maybe that's just the fireworks smell, but it's all over me. Freedom. America. These dudes know how to do freedom. I'll see you tomorrow.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty on demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
About something about a comedic tone.
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty on demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.